I'm Barbara Rossing, Associate Pastor here at Holden. And the title of this session is Christian Community Insights from African Spirituality, which might seem to be a sort of incongruous way to follow up yesterday's session on Jean Vanier's book, Community and Growth. But when I think about the topic of community, my thoughts turn quickly to Africa and insights that I've learned from Tanzanian or South African or Namibian Christians. And so that's what I want to share some with you today in this session. Prior to coming to Holden Village a little over a year ago, I worked for 4.5 years for the American Lutheran Church's Division for World Mission in Minneapolis as on the communications staff, and had the opportunity to do a lot of traveling, number of trips to Africa, specifically to first to East Africa, several trips to South Africa and Namibia, and then a couple trips also to West Africa, where I visited in January of this year of 1987. And I continually feel drawn back to Africa, I guess just very personally, because I would say in a lot of ways that my faith was shaped, strengthened by experiencing the church in Africa and the vitality, the faith, the commitment of African Christians and African churches. For myself, probably the biggest breakthrough was in the area of prayer. I had a lot of struggles with prayer before I went to Africa the first time in 1981, and still do. I don't know if there are among you some who struggle with that too, but I'd say I was really converted to prayer by a Cameroonian woman whose incredible prayers with me, for me, really had an amazing impact. And also by the prayers and faith of a number of other Africans that I met who were so deeply committed to prayer and prayed regularly for us, for me, for our churches, that I was really convinced of the importance of intercessory prayer in a way that I hadn't ever been in this country. And so that's been the most powerful probably for me in my own faith, but I think also a sense of community which truly is lived out in churches in Africa in a very strong way. That I think that if there's one thing that we as American, North American Christians need to be strengthened in our faith and learn from Africans, even as we share our resources with them, still by sending scholarship assistance, missionaries, money, material development aid, in return, the gifts that Africans can share with us that we desperately need in our churches are the sense of community and the strength of their faith that I think can really help carry us now through this century and into the next. African churches are growing at an amazing rate. There's something really powerful going on in the church in Africa today that I think can help us in our faith. Just want to read a quote to sort of set that stage from my former boss, who's going to be the director of the World Mission Division in the new church also. We're really excited about that. Mark Thompson, who says essentially that we both have gifts to share. God blesses the global church with a variety of gifts. Churches of Africa, Asia, and Latin America have gifts of faith, hope, and zeal to share with the global church. Even while they continue to receive European and American financial support to carry out their ministry, American and European churches, despite our seeming financial strength, may depend for our very future existence upon the faith, hope, and wisdom of the global churches that we financially support. And I think most powerfully it's faith, hope, zeal, and I'd say a sense of community that we receive from African churches in a wonderful way. So that's what I want to talk a little bit about today. And then continue to hear from you about your experiences with community, your experiences with Africans or other global people who have shaped or influenced you, and kind of some of those insights too. I put up on the board here this little poster with this quote that I kind of want to start with here. It's in the Xhosa language from South Africa. It's a little parable. Ubuntu, Nguntu, Nkabantu. And I invite you to say it with me. I'll say it one more time and then invite you to repeat it. Ubuntu, Nguntu, Nkabantu. Ubuntu, Nguntu, Nkabantu. And what that means is basically a person is a person because of other people. And I think that is a basic tenet of the African mentality, Christian or secular, whatever. That's just part of an African's outlook on life that is very, very biblical, that basically expresses in a powerful way that sense of community. Not sort of the Descartes model of I think, therefore I am, or I eat, therefore I am, or whatever we have in our individualistic culture here in Western civilization, but this profound sense of I exist, I am a person because of other people. The community comes before the individual and is what shapes the individual. Just read the bottom of that. They call it here a little proverb that parents would teach their kids, and over you'll hear that in Africa. A person is a person because of other people. It's almost impossible to imagine an individual without a community, and I think that's very scriptural. Just want to, I'll be referring a lot to a couple different books. First of all, this one, I don't think we've got it in the bookstore, but anyway, this is put out by Orbis Press. They've got a lot of great Latin America books and also a number of African theology books. And this one, Joseph Donder's Non-Bourgeois Theology, I've found very helpful. The subtitle is An African Experience of Jesus. And it basically talks about the church in Africa and theological insights that can be of help to us, and I've really enjoyed it. But I'll just read a paragraph here. In the African view, a person is seen first and foremost as a social being, a community member, a participant in the common human life. The Ghanaian scholar John Poby noted in his book Toward an African Theology, sociologists have long pointed out that while Descartes philosophized cogito ergo sum, that's I think, therefore I am, the Akan Society of Ghana would rather argue I belong by blood relationship, therefore I am, or the same idea. I am connected with other people, therefore I am. And that's a fundamental difference between our culture and theirs that I think is important now. You know, a lot of people are writing books on community these days in the U.S. Different drummer just came out. What's that guy's name? Scott Peck just wrote a book on community. Everybody's writing on community now in our country because we have this deep longing for community. Habits of the Heart was 2 years ago probably the most significant religious book to come out that sort of unmasked our individualism in our American culture as being sort of devastating to us as individuals and as communities, and trying to help us recover a sense of religious community. We desperately need that in our churches, in our life as a nation too. And I think that Africans really can enrich us in some amazing ways by sharing these insights of community. In Africa, to join the church means to join a new community. It's really that sense of switching realms, of changing communities from one family to another family, a new family in Christ. It's not kind of an individual conversion experience so much as it is a change of communities. Just want to read, now this book was one I really like, Christianity Rediscovered by Vincent Donovan. He's a Roman Catholic priest who served as a missionary to the Maasai people in Tanzania for many years. Tanzania has probably been the nation that has most deliberately tried to carry out that African sense of familyhood or community in structuring its national life with the whole concept of Ujamaa, which you might have heard of. It was pioneered by former Tanzanian President Julius Nyerere. It was to be the sort of African socialism that would govern that country has not been a great success by any means. But the philosophy of it, of truly finding a kind of socialism that is not Marxist-Leninist in outlook or background, but is an African kind of socialism, is very highly respected in Africa. And the problem has been trying to implement that in the nation's economic life or whatever. But anyway, one of the groups of people in Tanzania and also in Kenya is the Maasai people, really noble, amazing tribe of people. And Donovan was himself converted to a new understanding of Jesus and of God through his work with the Maasai people in Tanzania. And I'll just read a couple quotes from that, if that's okay. He's talking about he had been working with this village for a couple of years and was moving towards baptisms. As I was nearing the end of the evangelization of the first Maasai communities, I began looking towards baptism. So I went to the old man Dangoya's community to prepare them for the final step. I told them I had finished imparting the Christian message as much as I could. I had told them everything I knew about Christianity. Now it was up to them. So I stood in front of the assembled community and began. The old man sitting here has missed too many of our instructions. He was out herding cattle. He will not be baptized with the rest. These two on this side will be baptized because they've always attended. So did this young mother. She will be baptized. But that man there has obviously not understood the instructions. And that lady there has scarcely believed the gospel message. They cannot be baptized. And this warrior here has not shown enough effort. Dot, dot, dot. The old man, Dangoya, stood up and stopped me politely but firmly. Father, why are you trying to break us up or separate us? During this whole year that you have been teaching us, we have talked about these things when you were not here at night around the fire. Yes, there have been lazy ones in this community, but they have been helped by those with much energy. There have been stupid ones, but they have been helped by those who are intelligent. Yes, there are ones with little faith in this village, but they have been helped by those with much faith. Would you turn out and drive off the lazy ones and the ones with little faith and the stupid ones? From the first day I have spoken for these people, and now I speak for them, I can declare for them and for all this community that we have reached the step in our lives where we can say, we believe. We believe. Communal faith. And then he talks sort of about the whole question of is that valid, and comes to the conclusion that yes, indeed it is. As he searches the scripture, discovers how we carry one another. As man said today, we carry each other's burdens. We can carry each other in our faith. Bonhoeffer says that too, that when the Christ in me is weak, I can be carried by the Christ in you. And this idea that we believe, that's the Nicene Creed is phrased as that kind of plural, that our communal faith can carry us at times of struggle or laziness or stupidness, whatever, foolishness in our individual lives. And so he did baptize the whole village because there was such a sense of not splitting the community. And I think part of the reason Donders says this too, that Christianity is growing so fast in Africa, is this incredibly strong identification with biblical faith when they discover it. There's almost a connection between African people and the people of the Old Testament that we can never feel because our culture is so different from that. The love of stories, for example, the power of names. You know, have you ever wondered why a name in the Old Testament means so much? They tell you what every name means. But Africans can really understand that because African kids are all named with a name that means something. I'll never forget the story, for example, of Pastor Farisani, one of his colleagues. What is his name? Drawing a blank here. Anyway, one of the young pastors from Venda who was imprisoned and tortured by the South African government because he wouldn't back down on opposing apartheid. And while he was in prison and being tortured, his wife gave birth to a child. and they named that child Forgive. And just the power of those names, that everybody's names mean something. Well, that's Old Testament faith also. Every name has a reason and has a meaning. The whole sense of blessing also. I mean, you wonder in that Jacob and Esau story, for example, why Isaac, when he found out he blessed the wrong kid, couldn't just sort of switch his blessing or whatever. I mean, there's a lot of strange things going on in the Bible that we don't quite understand the power of, but that Africans immediately seize on as speaking to them in a really powerful way. That you explain the reason for something with a story is really African and also really Old Testament. So there's a real strong sense of identification there of sort of that I think then Africa can impart to us of helping us recover that excitement, that incredible sort of sense of connection with the Bible at points where we don't connect. Another story, for example, I mean, trying to think of all the strange stories, the story of Ananias and Sapphira, you know, in the book of Acts, when they didn't turn over the proceeds from, what did they do? They sold a field, didn't they? They sold a field, and then they kept the money for themselves. And they were struck dead because they hadn't shared that money with the community. Well, to us, it seems very, almost superstitious or unrealistic and also very harsh. But an African can instantly sort of understand that sense of cursing that comes when you separate yourself from the community through deceit like that. I think it's really exciting to sort of get African insights on a lot of these biblical stories. I'll just read a quote here from Donders about that, about the incredible rate of growth of the church in Africa too. In 1980, there were 200 million Christians in Africa. The number is growing at a rate of 4% a year. In certain countries, the growth rate is as high as 10% a year. And right now in Ethiopia, for example, the Lutheran Church is growing at a rate of 15% a year. In spite of fairly serious harassment / persecution by the government, that church is the fastest growing Lutheran church in the world right now. Amazing growth rates. By the year 2000, there will be 350 million Christians in Africa, more Christians than on any other continent. It is as if Jesus Christ really comes home somehow in Africa, comes into his own. Africans love to tell you how Jesus did spend some time in Africa. You know, we tend to forget that, but his parents took him to Egypt for who knows how long. So that is really important to Africans, that Jesus went to Egypt and did live in Africa and is coming home again in a real way in that continent. Also, a favorite story is the story of the Ethiopian eunuch in the book of Acts. I think it's chapter 10 there? This sort of really exciting story about the man who was riding in his chariot reading scripture and asked for help, what does this mean, and got baptized right there. That was an Ethiopian then who presumably went back to Ethiopia and told his people about it. And Ethiopia is one of the oldest Christian churches in the world. It's a country that has had Christianity for over 1,000 years, for a long, long time. Well, I kind of got distracted there. Okay, some examples of sort of the excitement that that an African outlook on some Christian concepts can bring. I'll just read one little story here from Donovan about the Maasai people. Feel free, if you have questions or comments, jump in, okay? I'm not trying to dominate this here. He's just talking about the Maasai. I love to read his stories about the Maasai here. It's just fascinating. I came across an extraordinary custom of the Maasai. Sometimes sin occurs not between individuals, but among groups in the same community. One family might offend another family, and disruption sets in on the whole community. This can be disastrous to a nomadic type community who must have unity above all else. A disruption like this can rupture the whole agreement or covenant in which the community first came together and on which it remains together. If at all possible, both the offending and the offended family must be brought together by an act of forgiveness sought and bestowed. So at the behest of the total community, both families prepare food. The word for food in Maasai is enda. But this will be a special kind of food, meaning holy food. This holy food is brought to the center of the village by the two families, accompanied by the rest of the community, encouraging both families all along the way. Then in the center of the village, the food is exchanged between the two families, each family accepting the food prepared by the other family. Then the holy food is eaten by both families, and when it is, forgiveness comes, and the people say that a new covenant has begun. The Maasai word for covenant is osutua. A new covenant is begun, a new testament of forgiveness brought about by the exchange of holy food. What can one say? You know, that's communion, that kind of forgiveness that comes through exchanging food with each other. Where enemies are become friends, enemies are loved and forgiven. A real powerful experience of forgiveness.
It's interesting that you're saying that the church is growing so fast. I was in Africa about, I'm not sure of the year, but it must be about 8 years ago. And while we didn't go to any of their churches, as we were driving along on a Sunday, we would see the people walking to church carrying their Bible. And just from my observation, when I came back, I said, Africa is going to have more Christians than Minneapolis, Minnesota, where we were from, because there's so many in Minneapolis that have never stepped inside of a church. And that was my observation, and it's hard to understand. We flew into Tanzania and then went all along the East Coast down to Cape Town and through there, and it was so peaceful and calm at Johannesburg and Pretoria, the capital, no trouble. And when I hear of all that trouble in Johannesburg now, it's hard to believe.
Yeah, I think there's really a sense that we might need to consider having Africans be missionaries to us in this continent to help reinterpret the gospel to us and assist us in our outreach, basically. Because, you know, church growth is, overall church membership is declining in this country every year, the number of Christians. And why is it that we're not able to reach one another with the gospel? What do we need? And maybe insights from Africa would really be of assistance to us. It would be an exciting sort of full circle to have the very nations who were evangelized by us now in turn evangelize us. That's the thesis of a very prominent mission scholar named Leslie Newbegin in his most recent book, where he talks about that we now need third world Christians to come to this country and evangelize us, because we are the new pagans, the new pagan country culture in a significant way.
Is there some conflicts, though, between some of the old African beliefs and superstitions and witch doctors with the new Christianity? Or is that can Christianity kind of encompass that, or is there real clashing there?
Yeah, that's a real important topic right now in all the people who are doing work with African theology. The earliest missionaries who went to Africa too often communicated the gospel as, if when you come to believe in Jesus Christ, you give up your culture. It means giving up African culture and becoming Westerners, accepting our culture because we're a Christian culture, kind of. To the point that you see some really strange things now, like in a lot of the churches in Tanzania and stuff, for example, the men sit on one side and the women sit on the other side, and you ask them, why do you do this? Where'd you get that? Well, the Germans brought that to us. Oh, great. You know, so there was originally a very strong sense that African culture was superstitious, it was animistic, they were worshiping nature, they were worshiping rocks and trees, they didn't have a faith that could be compatible with Christianity. There was also a lot of times this idea that of individual conversion, and then when a family would become baptized, they'd move on to the mission station, they'd leave their old family and ties and relatives and everybody behind. So there was a lot of notion of having to throw that out too much. Probably where it hit hardest was on, how come I can't remember these words, polygamy. there was a strong sense among most of the churches that evangelized in Africa that when a man would become a Christian, he would have to send away one of his wives, which of course is very, very cruel. And now the churches are getting away from that more and more. When you become a Christian, you're not allowed to marry any more wives, but you're not expected to desert any that you might already have. But now there is this sense of, let's go back and look at African traditional culture and see what elements of it are indeed not only compatible with the gospel, but even can enrich the gospel, or can make it, the gospel, more meaningful. And it's really hard to know. As you look at aspects of faith and life there, what is compatible and what's not. I mean, we find that in our culture too, of all the sort of kind of all the casual ways that we engage in idolatry by worshiping our money, by worshiping, you know, so many things that we can't seem to give up, and how to decide what aspects of our culture are just sort of neutral. The Luther's word for that is adiaphora, what doesn't matter, and what things really are negative or bad that we should give up if we're truly to be Christians, what aspects. And in every culture, there's both. There's some things that you know, the gospel doesn't say anything about, and it doesn't matter. You know, it's either fine or it doesn't really matter. And then there's other things that are in contradiction with the gospel of Christ. So it's trying to sort all that out. I would say on the witchcraft and things like that, that it's really exciting now, some of the theological work that's being done. The whole sense of extended family is really biblical, and to ask Africans to give up that aspect of their culture is really wrong. On the other hand, to many people, what the extended family means is also extended family with your ancestors. Those spirits are still alive, and there's sorcery going on, and fear of those spirits also. Fear of an uncle who's going to put a spell on you or something like that. I mean, so obviously some of that is really bad when it creates so much fear and so much suspicion of your relatives, and fear of the power of spirits, who we believe that the spirits have been dethroned by Jesus Christ. And so that sense of the power of the gospel is not compatible with still believing that spirits have those kinds of powers to take life or to terrorize us. But it's hard to sort all that out. Another one would be the witch doctors, as you say. Most people now would make a distinction between traditional medicine, like herbal medicine, much of which is very, very good, and the witch doctors or witchcraft and the voodoo and stuff like that, which is very bad. But sometimes it's hard to know where the line is between those, and what is good as far as a holistic view of medicine. In fact, there too, in the whole area of medicine and healing, I think there's a lot that we need to learn from Africans about. Well, we are. More and more now, healthcare in America is a sort of idea that you bring in the family. It started maybe with problems like alcoholism and stuff, where you realize you cannot just treat one person. You have to work with the whole family. The relationships are really important. And that is certainly a very African notion of healing, too. But some of the witch doctor stuff is obviously really bad, and how to sort that out is exciting. And these guys do a lot of work with some of that stuff. Maybe we've swung too far in sort of saying that everything about, kind of romanticizing African culture now to the point of thinking that it's better than it is, and I don't want to do that. But I think it is really important to affirm what is positive.
Isn't Islam very, very prominent in Africa?
Yeah, and it's growing too. Mm-hmm. It's growing as fast as Christianity is.
I heard when a person was telling me he was celebrating their sacred day, and their sacred day was the day that Abraham did not slay Ishmael. Mm-hmm. It wasn't Isaac, it was just the exact opposite.
Mm-hmm.
And that was their...
Yeah, and Islam is very aggressive at evangelizing, like Christianity, and very effective also, because there is some too often, and this is our fault, the fault of the history of the missionary enterprise, there's a sense, a strong sense, that Islam is a more African faith than Christianity is, because Christianity is a Western faith. When in fact, Christianity did not originate in the West. Christianity originated in the Middle East, and then traveled very quickly to Africa. But we have so kind of made it into our European and North American religion with all the cultural baggage that goes along with that, that a lot of people feel like Islam is a more African faith. Well, and we need to really work.
I was reading the Minneapolis paper the other day. There were 1,000 people in Minneapolis celebrating the start of Ramadan. And that's just, isn't it?
Yeah, No, it's not Ramadan. No, that was in May.
Huh? Ramadan?
It was in May, I think.
Yeah, well, it was in the paper about that there were 1,000 and they were starving that. And I thought, I was surprised that there would be that many people.
In
our Minneapolis.
In my neighborhood, we now have a mosque. And when that was being built, oh, I just turned my stomach. I just couldn't believe what was happening.
Where is that?
Seattle, Washington.
Let's see, 110th and 15th in the Middle East.
Just wanted to read a quote here about the sickness issue, and then let's open it up some more, because it really does address this question of herbal medicine and witch doctors, whatever. For the African, sickness is a relational problem. One is sick because one does not relate well to one's neighbor, to the community, to nature, or to God. African doctors try to know as much as possible about their patients. They try sometimes in very dramatic ways to restore appropriate relationships. In other words, African doctors have always been very aware of the psychosomatic aspect of human sickness. You know, here we are paying small fortunes to understand holistic medicine, and they've got that going already. This does not mean that no medicines are used. Herbs are important. Herbs are plants in which God has obviously put special life-giving powers. They can stimulate and heal human life because of those powers. Western doctors, too, admit that herbs can be effective, but they view the function of herbs in a very different way. And then he goes on to talk about ways that we can learn from Africans on the whole way of viewing sickness and healing. There's a lot of insights there, too. So I think it's really exciting to think about, you know, just all the ways that our thinking is turned upside down if you put the community first. Obviously, there's... that's very jarring to us as Americans. We're individuals first and foremost, but yet I think that it can really unpack a lot of biblical faith for us and make it come alive in some new ways, and that Africans really can help us on this.
My husband's a doctor, and we worked in African Botswana, and we went out in the boondocks for a couple of weeks, just with whatever we could take in our truck and so on. We got into one of the towns there, and oftentimes the African people, even if they come in with snake bite or something, and you tell them, you know, what you can do, they want to ask the traditional doctor first. Many times they do. And in this particular case, when we got through with the work we were doing, my husband asked the man at this little place where we were staying if he knew a local traditional doctor. And he told us where there was one. So we went over there with our nurse as an interpreter. And we had a really good session with him. He just showed us all the different things he used for different things. He was very excited about him. And it got us, well, then he asked him if they ever had if he ever had a case he couldn't cure having to do with eyes, because my husband's an eye specialist. So he said, do you ever have any cases, he said, where you're not able to cure someone with an eye problem? And he said, yes, he said, right now it's very bad because my sister-in-law, who works for the government, can no longer type because she can't see. And so she wants, but she can't see to type. So he asked how old she was and so on. And he said, well, you know, I think I have something that'll help her, because he said she was going to lose her job. So he went and got some reading glasses, you know, just ordinary reading glasses that people about 40 years old usually have to have. So, the next day we went by, and he said, well, that was just wonderful. She was so glad she could see now, everything. So he tried to talk to some of the other missionary doctors. He said, you know, we should cooperate with these people instead of just writing them off, because we'll never be able to work with them if we don't try to understand. You know, we're not familiar. be witch doctors, but we certainly can cooperate. But I think Christian doctors as a rule do not want anything to do with them, so they need some healing there too.
And it is a really tough issue to know what is good and what is evil in all that. And what is of God and what is not.
But you do see things that just make you sick, like sometimes the witch doctor or the traditional doctor. I remember one beautiful young boy that had a problem with his stomach, and the doctor poured iodine type of thing in his eyes and blinded him so he could see a light. That makes you lose, you know, makes you disgusted. You really don't feel that stuff anymore.
There's questions, comments?
When you were talking about the strength of the African community and the church, when a family would join a church, the entire family, or is there examples where only part of a family might join the church?
Yeah, there are definitely examples of that.
What happens to the family then?
Well, that's a real question that missionaries are struggling with now, is should you wait with baptizing an individual until the whole family, until you've made every attempt to get the whole family to become Christian? I'm most familiar with the American Lutheran Church's work right now. My sister is working in Senegal in West Africa in an area that's 100% Muslim. She's an agricultural engineer, and the ALC has within the last 10 years started work there in northern Senegal. And they're starting now to really have to face that question of is it even good for an individual to be baptized as a Christian like that if they have no family support, and the family, and indeed it would be a case of that person would be disowned by their family. Is that really what God would want? Or is it better to have them worship with you and participate as they are sort of growing in faith, but not baptize them because of the incredible separation that puts between a person and their whole community? It's really hard to know.
This is a little off the track, but you know, we can send food all we want over there, and that doesn't solve the problem of starvation. What they really need over there is farm implements. And I understand they simply don't have the implements. If we can send arms to Iran or whatever, why is it so hard to send farm implements to Africa?
Yeah, there's a lot more there than it's the upkeep and maintenance also of implements. I mean, driving through northern Senegal, you see just one disastrous development project after another. Well-intentioned European or Americans who had brought windmills or pumps or various things to try to help irrigate, and people just are not able to maintain those. There's not the commitment to using them or whatever. So it's not just the tools, it's also finding implements that are appropriate. Yeah, and it's education. I mean, the whole idea of appropriate technology, that some technology that might work there physically or technically is not appropriate because it's not in people's interest to use it. So it's a really complex thing that development workers are always struggling with. But yeah, you're right. Sending food is not a long-term solution. It's got to be development. And
well, sometimes we even try to change their diet and everything else, which is difficult.
This is also a little bit different, but talking about first world church struggling to be community with a third world church. I'm part of American Baptist community in California, and we have a sister church in Nicaragua, which is a very Christian country. And I think we've had the relationship for a couple of years, and basically what our little community wanted to do was to have a direct link with another Christian community in a country that certainly has a lot of trouble. And our understanding is the church is very, very alive, very much like Africa. It's a different culture, but there's a lot of similarities in terms of the poverty and the hunger, maybe not quite as bad as Nicaragua as in some parts of Africa, and the persecution and the confusion, and certainly is extremely dangerous in Nicaragua also. And this little church is our sister church is in a little town called Chichigalpa, which is in the northern western part of Nicaragua. So it's way, way out in the sticks. I mean, it doesn't have, it's not anywhere close to Managua. The entire budget for the church is $50 a month, which is a great strain for that congregation. Their congregation is larger, probably by about three times than ours. They meet in a room, we've seen pictures of it, which is probably about the size of this room, and there's absolutely nothing on the walls. I mean, they have no money. They have absolutely no money. They have benches. There are bullet holes in the church because during the Civil War a few years ago, it was taken over by the army, which was then overthrown, and the church was moved out entirely, and the army used it as a garrison. And so during some of the fighting, the whole place was shot up. And one of the things, well, the main thing that we're trying to do is struggle with how to be community with them. As we hear their stories, and of course there's a problem with translation of the language, although Spanish is a much easier language to translate than some African languages, I'm sure. But how to be in community with them. And one example that absolutely blows our minds is this church is, it's a Nicaraguan Baptist church, is a part of the central structure of the community. There's very little organization within the town, and the church is one of the pillars of the community, you might say. And they wanted to provide some kind of education for some of the young people, particularly the young boys, so that they would be able to do something with their lives. And so what they are trying to teach them how to do is be carpenters. But the trouble is they have absolutely no wood, because there's no, although Nicaragua used to be heavily forested, that was all harvested by probably mostly Americans, and so there's absolutely no wood. So they might have one 2x4 of about 3 feet long, and they have 35 young boys in this carpentry class, and they have a few hammers and other tools that have been donated by, I think, West Germans. And what they would do is they would draw pictures of wood on the blackboard, and they'd say, if you had a piece of wood, this is how you would cut it. And you would hold the saw this way, and this is what a piece of wood feels like, and they would pass it around, that kind of thing. And what we're trying to do is figure out how to communicate with them, and we took up a special offering, which we do occasionally, I mean, fairly often, a few weeks ago, and in that offering, we took in $300. Which is 6 months of their budget. Absolutely mind-blowing. I mean, that was just, and that was not a strain, even though our congregation was very small and not wealthy. And so, and yet we have a feeling, as you have said, they have a tremendous amount to teach us about faith. They are a joyous community. They are absolutely alive. It's so obvious. Their children send us things that they make. And the people write to us, and the pastor is a literate person who writes it down. And they have a tremendous amount to share with us about faith and about joy. Mm-hmm. And what we have to share with them is money, but we know that that's the least that we have to share with them. But we have to search within ourselves to find what we have to give to them, and we are really the ones that are impoverished in every way except for money in some ways. So that's
it. Oh, that sounds great. Yeah, I saw when I was in Nicaragua, the saddest. I mean, you sometimes don't realize how poor poverty is until something like that with the wood. Or we saw sewing classes where the girls were sewing beautiful little dresses out of paper because they couldn't afford cloth. Spectacular clothes made out of paper. It was just... so thanks, yeah. I was going to say, just following up on that, there is one thing... that Africans really do say that we can share, because I, would go on these trips saying, you know, what can we do for you? What do you want from us? And certainly things like scholarships, money, material assistance, personnel, missionaries, especially skilled technical people who would have some of the skills that people there wouldn't, are really important. But the first request that I always got when I say, you know, what do you want from me? Prayer. The first and most important. I just want to read a little quote on that from Bishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa. Really a powerful quote that I always keep in mind when I sort of think, I don't feel like praying, or, you know, prayer. What is that? This was in a sermon that he gave to a U.S. audience a couple years ago in Washington, D.C. We know in our experience what it is meant to be upheld by the love and prayers of so many people around the world. It has been almost a physical sensation, this being carried by your servant prayers. We are able to witness in South Africa as we do because you are faithful in your witness where you are. Sometimes you may not feel like praying. God seems miles and miles away, and you say to God, I want to pray, and I'm going to pray. And because you are faithful, someone in South Africa suddenly receives an excess of grace. Inexplicably, it appears. A woman's home is going to be demolished tomorrow. She's part of a community that's going to be uprooted because it doesn't fit into the ideological map of apartheid. Churches, clinics, schools have been demolished. The water supply has been stopped. The bus service is interrupted. The people are going to be moved. And this woman, whose home is going to be demolished tomorrow, sets out to pray. She says, God, thank you for loving us. How can that be except that you here have prayed her into that state of grace? So Tutu really believes that it's our prayers that are able to keep them going, doing what they're doing there. And I think that's pretty amazing. The prayer support is the most important request that people have. Got a letter one time from Dean Ferrisani in Venda, one of those Lutheran pastors who was arrested and tortured, has become very well known because he was adopted by Amnesty International as a prisoner of conscience. And he's also an incredible pastor, an incredible speaker on the whole idea of loving one's enemies. And he wrote to us after we visited him and his family for a weekend in South Africa. He says, God's mercies, love, and grace are not seasonal. We continue to witness and worship the Spirit in spite of everything. We pray that our climatic and racial drought will come to an end, that we shall have something to eat and somebody to love. We neither ask for a trip to the moon nor a place in the spacecraft Challenger, but a place in your prayerful hearts. This was right after the Challenger was launched. So anyway, it's prayers that people ask for from us, and we can really do that. No, I think you're really right. It is really difficult for Americans to commit to community. It's so alien to our culture. That's the whole question that Bella and those others raise in that book, Habits of the Heart. Are we even capable of community in America? I mean, are we so individualistic that we're not even capable of community? And is our latest fascination with community and communities now in the 80s, is this just our latest form of individualism to dabble with the whole idea of community kind of at our convenience because it meets our individual needs at this point? It's really hard. And I don't know what the answer is. I don't know what the breakthrough is, but I do think there's a connection between when our faith is mediocre and when we're trying to live as individuals. I mean, I really do think that we grow in faith and grow in understanding of Christianity and commitment to it as we're involved in community. At least that's certainly been my experience. So that in order for our faith to survive, we have to be in community. And I don't know how to find it.
May I ask one more question? Is there something in the African church, as you've experienced it, in terms of understanding the liberating message of the gospel now, that is similar to the base community sharing of the gospel in Central and South America? I mean, when you talk about the great growth of the churches of Africa, how is that happening? Through small groups that are meeting together and talking together in addition to their membership in individual congregations?
I haven't seen that as much, anything really paralleling the base community movement in Latin America. And I don't know if I've only visited Africa. I think there's a lot of things that I haven't seen. So I don't know if it's going on there or what. There is now more and more excitement with being captured by the liberating power of liberation theology, especially in Southern Africa, Namibia, and South Africa, where the oppressor is still so very much a part of life. But I don't know on base communities, on the small groups. I mean, I saw many small groups, the women's groups, the young people's groups, whatever, doing amazing ministry and working together and studying together, but they don't. I don't think it's as formally organized a movement. One of the books in our bookstore, well, two actually that we've got, African Worship, so three, how's that, to promote some resources. These two South African ones, or this one is Namibia, Why, O Lord, Psalms and Sermons from Namibia by Zephaniah Kamita, who's actually taught here at Holden, is excellent. Liberation Theology Interpretation of the Psalms by this outstanding Namibian Christian theologian and pastor. I'd really recommend it. And this definitely takes a liberation theology perspective on the whole situation in Namibia. Some wonderful prayers and psalms in here. And then this one from South Africa by John DeGrucci, Cry Justice, same kind of thing, looking at African hymns and songs and the liberating power of that. And then one other that I'd recommend that's in the store that we use and sing so much here that I forgot to bring it because it's just so much part of our life I didn't think of it as being African, is a songbook and a cassette tape. Is it called Freedom is Coming? Freedom is Coming. That's by a Swedish singing group picking up on some African songs. Just wonderful. We sing those a lot here. And one of the songs on that tape, I think, just sort of epitomizes the relationship between liberation and Christian faith in the oh freedom, the first verse is oh freedom, freedom is coming, and the next verse is oh Jesus, Jesus is coming, and sort of the back and forth between Jesus is coming, freedom is coming, Jesus is coming, freedom is coming, the interrelationship there about Christ as the liberation of our lives. And it's you could say it's really political. There's just not that kind of separation there. Yeah, liberation is the Christian gospel in the South African context. I'd really recommend that cassette and songbook. We love those songs.
There is a group of people which is a group which is ecumenical, and it's based a great deal on prayers, started at McAllister College around 50 years ago by Glenn Carr. And it's called Camps Farther Stop, and there is a group of people that will come together. It doesn't make any difference what denomination you are, and it's a supportive group in prayer. And also, they have a camp which meets, and this is spread not only in the United States but all over the world. And they meet together in the camp, and one of the highlights is the prayer, and also there are different activities which has to do with painting or drawing and drama, and then there are different ministers that will speak. And it really is a very supportive group. Now we have one at Dismal St. Paul, and I have gone to it quite a bit. Not only is that do they have this supportive group, there's also sharing if people want prayer. Mm-hmm. People call from all over the United States, and the group is small, and they meet in different states, and we went once to a group in Colorado, but they have them all over, and people have become very friendly all over the United States and go to these retreats.
So you really found community in that group.
You really find community, and it's Christian, it's based on prayer, but everybody is in, you know, anybody can come, and just through phone calls, people that are searching for answers, and they're loved and accepted. And like our group meets like once a week, and we just have a sharing time, and then we have finger foods and have a fellowship time, and it really is supportive. And
great. Others of you, where you found community?
Well, this is not community, but I had, with the power of prayer, I had a little grandchild that was born with a hole, and we have a prayer chain in our church. So she was on that, and when she was supposed to go for a surgery, then when she got old enough, and they did a catheterization, but she had a cold, so they said, well, we can't do it, so they sent her home, and she came back I think 3 months later or something, and the hole in the heart healed, so she had Mm.
Sounds like community to me in a prayer chain.
Yeah, we have a great church.
Mm. That's great.
People like this community because they don't know each other, you know, like people they can't bring problems to their own church, you know, and it's real.
Yeah, and that's the 12-step model too with some of those groups. Yeah. It's the anonymity sometimes, ironically, that makes you be able to be more open and take risks with each other.
And the whole hope of the group is to bring this back into the church, mm-hmm. so it isn't working against the church.
Great. Okay, I think it is 11:45 here, so we need to break. Thanks a lot, everybody. I'd love to hear from more of you about your experiences, too.
Thank you.